WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Kaufman has spent considerable time traveling around the country photographing diners, their exteriors, interiors, and the people who work and eat in them. His photographs are featured in the new book, American Diner, which also tells the history of dining cars and roadside diners. Kaufman will be with us at 3 o'clock today. With me now on Fresh Air is Michael Arlen, the television critic for The New Yorker magazine. A new book of his collected essays has just been published under the name The Camera Age. It's been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. And his book, 30 Seconds, has just been published in paperback by Penguin Books. 30 Seconds tells the entire story of the making of one Bell Telephone commercial, the one which started off their Reach Out and Touch Someone campaign to encourage more frequent long-distance telephone calls. Michael Arlen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, glad to be here.
In a review of your book in the New York Times Sunday section recently by Robert Brustein, Brustein wrote that a lot of people detest television as a form, but are fascinated with it as a phenomenon. And I wonder if that sentence describes you or anyone else you know.
No, and I'm not sure that it really describes too many people, though possibly Bob Brustein. I didn't think that really that observation was sort of the best of Brustein. I think he's a wonderfully smart man, certainly about theater and a number of other things. But I think that people get very defensive and sometimes primitive about television. I was thinking about television as it compares to politics. Hundreds of years ago, I mean, even at the time of the French Revolution, people felt in such a primitive way about politics and certainly about the authorities of politics that they really couldn't stand to hear any ill spoken. They just, even at the time of the French Revolution, an enormous number of people in France had such a reverence for the king. They didn't really want to approach political life, let's say, or they couldn't approach political life at a higher level of consciousness. And this certainly is still true today, though people have grown up a lot about it, you know. I think television seems to connect to people in somewhat the same way. By and large, people have a very primitive approach. They have their heroes, they're villains, I suppose. But anyway, they mainly want to deal with it on a primitive level, which is, you know, approval, disapproval. I don't want to think about it. Though, in fact, as certainly has been the case with politics, many other things are going on at the same time. And these are the things that interest me to try to figure out.
I've quoted this before, but Larry Gross, who's been on the show a few times and does a lot of communications research, once said that whenever he meets someone who is going to talk to him about a television program, they always begin with a justification of why they happen to be watching TV.
Well, I think it's a very intimate experience. And one of the things that fascinated me about Network and the response to Network was that I didn't think that the enormous response of the audience had that much to do with Peter Finch as the, you know, the angry anchorman, because in a way that was an awfully conventional role he played. I mean, the sort of the Gregory Peck against the system. And it seemed to me that the real response of the audience had much to do with this intimate relationship that television has to most people. And in writing about it, what I find interesting and where I think that editors maybe are a little bit remiss in that they don't encourage other writers to deal with it in this way, is that the most interesting thing about television is the experience of watching it. And usually the individual program itself is of, you know, subordinate interest.
Do you like watching TV?
Well, sure. I mean, I certainly don't watch it round the clock. I mean, I like a certain amount of it. I mean, again, I think if you're going to write about a mass art, it isn't too interesting to overstate, let's say, one's cultural response to it. I think if all you have to say about television is that it's silly, culturally inferior, and by implication, I, the critic, am culturally superior, you're not really saying anything very meaningful. It seems to me that If you're talking about a program, let's say like Dallas, which appeals to, you know, millions and millions of people, you start with the simple fact of sort of respecting that fact. And then going on to try to figure out why that program has such an enormous response. But I think, you know, to like it or it's sort of beyond liking and disliking.
It exists. And
yeah.
Do you see it as being like a mirror that that reflects the way we are?
No,
or this image of what the networks think that we are?
No, I think it certainly isn't a mirror. I mean, it's lots of things. I think people who've grown up in the television era tend to think maybe out of this sort of love-hate relationship that a lot of people have with it, that the television sort of is a window on the world. What it seems to me to be is it's something not quite that. I mean, it certainly does show you a lot of stuff, but it's not a window on the world. A television news, for example, does not tell you everything that's going on. The television news people themselves would be the first to admit that. I think they get a little disingenuous about that because Walter Cronkite always used to sort of insist that the CBS Evening News was not supposed to be the only thing that people looked at, and that's perfectly true. It's not supposed to be, though the fact remains that it is the only thing that a lot of his audience looked at. But I think that one of the interesting things about television nowadays really has to do with this sort of a pendulum swing of, let's call it the visual sensibility or culture, because now that finally is getting more and more into television. And again, there are a lot of people who are growing up now who think of visual forms as being a higher form of reality. Now, when I was growing up, or certainly, let's say, my grandparents were growing up, there was little attention to visual forms. I mean, in fact, things were quite repressed in that way. For hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, verbal forms, language forms, were paramount. And then, as we know, in the early part of last century, this enormous breakthrough, freedom movement obtained, where, I guess first in France, painters figured out how to release visual forms from the servitude of, or the obligation of portraying, let's say, verbal information. And from that point on, I mean, picked up by photography, by film, and so forth, visual forms have been increasingly freeing themselves from, let's say, a literal or verbal logic and finding their own logic. So we're in a sort of a new era, but in a way the pendulum has swung rather far over to almost to another extreme.
Yeah, well, I was just listening to an interview today in which someone else was slamming television for preventing children from fantasizing and from thinking verbally. But, you know, going to a museum to see paintings is always considered an exalted experience.
Yes.
But other forms of visual communication, like television, movies, are considered to be experiences that cheapen your possibilities of being an intellectual.
Well, going back to what you were quoting of Mr. Brustein, and also this whole business of television as an experience, it seems to me, again, interesting that by and large people need to feel single-mindedly about television. It has to be apparently one thing or another. It has to be either Lucifer incarnate. It has to be something that destroys the minds of children, that unravels marriages, that causes the social fabric to totter. It has to either be that, or it has to be to listen, let's say, to some of the people in the television establishment. It has to be something wonderfully fun or simple or, you know, just plain all of us having a good time. And quite clearly, it's both those things and neither of those things. And more importantly, it's many of them all at once, all at the same time. I don't think television destroys society. I don't think sometimes it helps it very much. I think that it's ridiculous and in a way very sad to blame television for let's say its narcotic effect any more than one could blame let's say heroin for its narcotic effect. Well, no, that's actually not an accurate thing I said. One can blame heroin for its narcotic effect. But it seems to me that the crucial thing is that as long as the society we live in can't find, let's say, meaningful work for many of the people in that society, it's very hard and unrealistic to expect those people to get out of bed in the morning or get out of bed very, very readily. In an individual family, for example, parents, you know, worry enormously about the very young children who watch TV like addicts. And of course, the reason they watch TV like addicts is because they're, well, for various reasons, but they're very small people, extremely small people. They have very little say in their own lives, very little to do. There are very few possibilities for a six-year-old, except to stay home and have whatever fun they can have. Once these same kids start getting to be teenagers. I mean, they may be wonderful teenagers or dreadful teenagers, but they start watching often a lot less television. And I think throughout society, this society, you'll find, whether you do it with statistics or not, the people who have an active role in society, whether they're young or old or fat or thin, tend to, you know, watch a modest amount of television. And those who are out of work and disenfranchised feel powerless, feel that they have no useful part to play in this country, watch it an awful lot.
How do you decide what you're going to watch?
Well, I try to figure out something interesting to say about it. And if I can figure that out in advance... let's say I'm thinking about Dallas. You know, I'm trying to figure out what is, let's say, special about Dallas beyond the stuff that you read about. You know, and so while I'm figuring that out, I'll watch a whole bunch of Dallas programs, but I certainly don't stay home watching the set all the time. In fact, I the New Yorker has been very tolerant with my eccentricities. I've been doing this now for close to 16 years, and I think the reason I've been able to do it without losing my mind is that, first of all, I've taken, you know, a lot of time off to write books of a quite different nature, and also I've done a lot of, so to speak, getting out of the office. I mean, in 1967, I went to Vietnam to cover the way the news was being brought in from Vietnam, and I've covered, you know, political campaigns from the point of view of the media coverage in the field, and the making of television commercials and so forth, and that tends to keep one a little lively.
What do you think the New Yorker reading audience wants to know about television? Because of all the magazine audiences I can think of, it's probably the New Yorker audience that would be or think of themselves as the least interested in a, you know, consumer's guide to, you know, what to watch tonight on TV or
to
gossip,
you see,
about,
I mean,
you know, who's doing what.
Luckily, no one has asked me to do a consumer's guide thing, and I don't do one. I sort of figure that there are plenty of people who do provide that kind of information perfectly well. But going back to talking about politics, I think that... there are any number of let's say, interesting and connective things to say about television that anybody in the country might be interested in reading about. However, a great many people in the country, it's hardly to their discredit as human beings, but have a, let's call it a fairly primitive response to television still. They really don't want to think about it as a complicated experience. They really do want to sort of witness, you know, whether it's I Love Lucy or Walter Cronkite or whatever, on a very simple level. And I think it's plain foolish for a writer to try to bully them into thinking differently. When I when I write for The New Yorker, I basically try to think of something that interests me. And I figure that if I'm doing my job and if I'm a good enough writer, people will read along with me, so to speak.
From watching a lot of television, what do you think some of the fantasies are that many Americans share, since a lot of TV programs, I think, are made to play off our fantasy life?
Well, I think probably fantasies don't ever change very much, you know. Like in the case of Roots, which was this enormous success, and of course, again, people don't really want to admit that they're plugged into a fantasy. So they say, Roots is wonderful because it reveals the dreadful plight of the black person. It educates millions of schoolchildren, black or white, about black history and so forth and so on. But I think it's more true to say that the real energy, the audience energy, the response energy in Roots comes from a very, very ancient fantasy that most of us have had at one time or another, which is the fantasy of going home. That somewhere in our past is somebody absolutely wonderful who's going to make everything all right for us. Now, the reality, as we know, often every time we all gather together for Thanksgiving, the reality that, as we know, if we have ever traveled to some remote place in some remote country, you know, to find one's roots, is that one's origins don't necessarily make us look good in the first place. And secondly, that home is very dangerous. It's a place of such psychic dangers that we've set up a whole mythology to sort of say it ain't so. It's a very human thing to dream of a golden past where I was represented, instead of by some 3-foot-tall, you know, kind of a, you know, who knows, a rather ramshackle figure, but instead by a mighty warrior, Kunta Kinte, you know, the great noble warrior. Well, maybe so. But you doubt it. I mean, really. Rather expect that had Alex Haley really found, in mummified form or whatever, his ancestors, they would be no different from any of our ancestors. Often a lot of trouble. And as a result, what Haley did, which is what many writers have done, given a choice between the untidy and rather difficult reality of, let's call it real life, composed a fantasy. And these fantasies are enormously popular. I mean, Gone with the Wind. It's a fantasy. It's an enormously popular, and the world would be poorer without these fantasies. I'm not saying they shouldn't be written, but I don't think that they're particular television fantasies, you know. I mean, I think television basically plugs into the ancient fantasies we've all been living with.
Do you think that docudramas are meant to plug into those fantasies more than to reveal history and education?
Oh, docudramas. I could talk for a week about docudramas. They're for the most part, a big mess. And whenever the docudrama people, you know, creators, producers, manufacturers, you know, start explaining what they're really doing, it's usually pretty self-serving. I notice that the names of Tolstoy and Shakespeare are often invoked in the cause of docudrama as being worthy fellows who are writing greats known to us all, who employed, you know, historical material and factual material in the service of literary creation. That's perfectly true. But, I mean, it's such a misleading thing to say in connection with docudrama, because when Tolstoy was writing about, let's say, the Battle of Borodino or Waterloo, whatever, I mean, his intention was not, so to speak, to blow the lid off the Battle of Borodino or Waterloo. And when Shakespeare was writing about the Battle of Agincourt, he was not trying to give you journalistic information about Agincourt. writing greats were giving you what they're supposed to do. I mean, great drama, great character, and that's why you read them. Docudrama people, however, though they may suggest it subtly or suggest it unsubtly, tell you that you're going to get the real poop. The reason you watch a docudrama is to get the real story, and people think they're getting the real story, and they're getting a whole lot of mishmash. And I think that's for different reasons, but not the least of them being that one of the transitional periods we're going through these years has to do with a respect for life. I think people are uncertain what kind of respect to grant to life and to other people's lives. They're working it out.
Do you usually try to watch a blockbuster docudrama so you can write about it?
Well, I've written about a few of them, and I don't sort of, you know, there's only so many you want to watch. I mean, sometimes I'll watch one just for the, you know, because I like to, but mostly I kind of, you know, I don't really.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit, but I want to reintroduce you first. I'm talking with Michael Arlen, who's the television critic for The New Yorker, and has a new book of collected essays called The Camera Age. And his book about the Reach Out and Touch Someone commercial, the making of that commercial, has just been released in paperback, and that's called 30 Seconds. You have a really interesting essay about, well, you refer to this a number of times, different kinds of interviewing and approaches to the news and to personalities. Let's start with Barbara Walters, and you use as your jumping-off point a program that was on a few years ago in which she interviews John Peters and Barbara Streisand and Jimmy and Rosalind Carter in the same show.
Barbara is a really loopy interviewer. As I think I remarked somewhere, or I certainly meant to, she's done this extremely interesting thing, which is to combine the interviewing styles of the higher Murrow and the lower Murrow. The higher Murrow, as we all know, was this wonderful, you know, broadcasting figure. But I think people tend to forget the lower Murrow, who, in his autumnal days at CBS, kind of waffled around in a program called
Person to Person,
showing people around houses and talking about, you know, interior decoration and, I don't know, stuff. You know, this, it was not a great moment in broadcasting, though Murrow was a noble figure. But anyway, Barbara, she does what's called the tough interview. The tough question, which is fine by and large. That's a good thing to do. But she does it all out of kilter, out of whack. I mean, the tough interview is a good thing to do when you're sitting down opposite, you know, Henry Kissinger or the late Shah of Iran. And she manages that sometimes. But it's a loopy thing to do when you're sitting down, let's say, opposite, let's say, John Peters or Halston or whatever it is, you know. And it's as if her news sense is a kind of very eccentric, you know, very eccentric matters. I mean, she doesn't always seem to know what's real news and what's sort of amiable nonsense. But I think that this whole matter of the tough interview, the tough question, which is sort of the part of the reason that propels 60 Minutes into our midst. I have a lot of mixed feelings about 60 Minutes, so by and large I think they've done some very interesting stuff, very good stuff, and I think people forget that before they came on the air, there was virtually no interviewing worth a damn on television, that the classic interview situation was, you know, there you see the smiley, blow-dried face of the local newscaster telling you that there's been a sort of a scandal at City Hall, he thinks, and we now go to the steps of City Hall where Buzz Cartwright, his on-the-spot roving correspondent, is about to interview the mayor, who may or may not have had his hand in the till, and the mayor comes down the steps, and Buzz Cartwright kind of shuffles over and sort of presents his microphone to the mayor, who, being no fool, takes it and then speaks into it whatever he wishes to speak about the new zoo that he's just opened or closed, or about his wife's trip to Mexico or his next election campaign, while Buzz Cartwright stands there, and that's the interview, which of course is no interview at all. So with TV news people being so generally inept in the matter of interviewing, or else doing that dreadful thing, which they still do, and they do it on networks too, which is the how do you feel question. You know, Mr. Columbus, how do you feel? As if how you felt really was the information that you most wanted to release. It's such a strange sort of, it's almost endearing in its ineptitude. I mean, somebody has done something really very interesting and complicated. He may have gone to the moon, discovered the new world, you know, the polio vaccine, who knows what. And all you can find to ask him is how he feels, as if he's going to tell you very much from that. It seems a sweet question, but really not quite what ought to be asked at that point. But anyway, so with most interviewing so inept, it was small wonder that people would find a way of doing some decent interviewing. And 60 Minutes, by employing partly old-fashioned journalistic techniques and partly theatrical techniques, and it's no coincidence, of course, that Wallace was first trained as an actor. This was his first work job. That they've been very successful, and I think that they, on balance, they've been a great credit to television, and I think they've done fine stuff. But now and then, they've done really lousy stuff, and they've done inaccurate stuff, and they've done stuff that oversteps the bounds of journalism. In the process, I mean, I think one has to say that all television journalism is, well, the better television journalism is trying to redefine what they're doing, because for so long they were sort of self-made prisoners of the conventions of print reporting. And as a kind of leftover of that era, is an interesting artifact that I think of as Dan Rather's Spiral Notebook. In any number of 60 Minutes interviews, it can be good interview, you know, a fine interview, let's say, you know, there is, I don't know, Mike Wallace, it could be, you know, with you know, the old Ayatollah, hunkering down in Qum or whatever, and presumably surrounded by some of the most elaborate and expensive recording and film equipment that money can buy. In other words, we're not worried about recording this interview. But there is Dan Rather, or Mike Wallace, with a spiral notebook on his lap, an old reporter spiral notebook into which he is penciling, well, one wonders. But anyway, it's a nice, I think one would have to say, anachronistic touch, and it indicates the extent to which a television journalism, even flashy television journalism, is still has one foot very heavily planted in the old print era.
But do you think that that's just theater, you know, a theatrical prop
yes,
show people that they know how to write and that they need to take notes?
It certainly is a theatrical a prop, and I think much of the mise-en-scène, let's say 60 Minutes, is theatrical. I mean, the whole wardrobe effect. I mean, these correspondents, you know, are all dressed up for the most part as 1950s Time reporters. I mean, the whole thing is really it's a little later than Citizen Kane, but it certainly isn't the present era. It's all done, quite deliberately, and there's no great harm in that. I mean, that's not the problem with 60 Minutes.
But you talk also about how some of the 60 Minutes reporters or anchors use a prosecutorial style in asking their questions instead of just simply asking tough questions. Can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
I think they do it all the time. As I say, sometimes to good effect, because you have to say that there are a bunch of people, you know, if you're going to try to get a straight answer out of, you know, certain well-established figures. They have such shields of lawyers, accountants, general imperturbability that it's very hard to get through to them, and sometimes you can't. 60 Minutes people by and large do, but it's a rather tricky method they use. And for example, a print reporter, a good investigative reporter, if you've ever listened to, let's say, Cy Hirsch in his office trying to get a story going, you know, you listen to this extraordinary telephone technique of cajoling and bullying and yelling and screaming and this and that, and one way or the other, Cy will put together that story. But when it appears in print, the story will be about, let's say, the content of the story. It won't be all this stuff about the difficulties he had getting it. But the 60-minute story is something different. And usually what the 60-minute story is about, as much as the content of it, is this handheld camera sort of following Mike or Dan or Morley or Harry, whatever, as they're going in the door and the people are putting up their hands, sort of clearly not wanting them to come in, and they're wandering around this corridor, then someone is kind of backing up against the wall, then suddenly you have, you know, J.P. Big Dome sitting in his chair looking kind of sweaty, and the camera closes in on that, and then Dan fires his tough question, and you get a close-up again, a very meaningful, you know, long-held close-up of the face of this guy, you know, trying to figure out the answer. And, of course, all this is later edited for effect and so forth. So there are lots of opportunities for screwing around, and I think, to be fair, you'd have to say that a great many times 60 Minutes does not screw around. They do a very good job. But they are increasingly driven, I think, by their success, quite plausibly, to repeat it and keep repeating it. The reason for their success has much to do with the theatrical dimensions of their program, the good guys, bad guys. So you're looking for good guys and bad guys. No, that's not exactly right. You have the good guys yourself. You're looking for the bad guys. You're looking for situations that will produce a good guy, bad guy definition. And so sometimes you tend to rather over-define those yourself.
When you wrote about this in The New Yorker, I understand you got a pretty angry response from CBS.
Well, there was a program they did a few years ago, a long program. In fact, it took two separate Sundays, which he did about corruption in Wyoming. And I knew a very little about Wyoming. I mean, certainly about corruption in Wyoming. And as I wrote in my piece, I had no doubt at all that plenty of corruption exists there. It's bound to, you know, all this new mineral stuff. But the stuff that 60 Minutes was talking about and saying, you know, we presume these fellows guilty, we'll have to wait for the grand jury to find out, which obviously left them seeming guilty in the eyes of this massive audience. A lot of those things could be checked out really by a phone call and didn't check out at all. And I thought here was a classic example, I think probably a fairly rare example, but still no reason not to mention it, of the prosecutorial tendency getting in the way of straight reporting. I mean, because Dan Rather was not doing straight reporting then. He was making a case in a quasi-legal situation where the other side had no, you know, counsel for the defense, where there was no judge, no jury, and so forth. It was just Dan Rather prosecuting and this immense audience. And I think that probably isn't what the Founding Fathers meant by, the function of a free press.
Let's talk about another kind of figure that's on particularly talk shows and news shows. And I think Willard Scott is the example you use for this new form of folksy.
Oh, this kind of phony folksy effect. Well, I think, truth to tell, that's been with us an awful long time. It's sort of, now that rural life is sort of, you know, more of a memory than ever, these kind of you know, neo-Will Rogerses. Charles Couralt on the road seemed to be another one of those. I mean, definitely a higher caliber Well, I don't know about person. I don't mean, I presume that Willard Scott's probably a pretty nice guy, whatever. But anyway, Kurrell is a notch above Willard Scott. It's that same sort of a spurious, rural, a good old boy individuality. And I think there's a place for that, but I think the place sort of gets overstated sometimes.
Do you see that cropping up, like, in New York City in more local settings, since, you know, New York is the furthest thing from rural folksy that you could get to?
I mean, I think this is a funny period we're living in, where large numbers of people seem to be sort of under the impression that they're kind of floating free and trying to make up identities as they go along. Fashion has been around for a long, long time, you know, obviously. But it seems to me that the extent to which large masses of people have been sort of reconstituting themselves, for example, as Texans. You know, the amount of Western gear in New York. I mean, one can hardly be surprised at Willard Scott when every third person in New York is dressed in Western gear, or this preppy stuff, or Chinese peasant, or, you know, Navajo costumery. People are clearly ill at ease with their own, you know, beings and natures, and are trying to sort of make up something else on the spur of the moment, which I think is awfully hard to do.
Do you see the number of jiggle shows subsiding now? Someone was telling me that they're cutting back on a few of them and that could possibly be attributed to the pressures from conservative groups.
Well, going back to the question of, you know, is television a mirror of society? I mean, you know, it most certainly isn't a mirror, at least not a very accurate mirror. Sometimes a funhouse mirror, you know. I think if the geniuses who, you know, do the polling and sampling for television could, you know, would tell the bosses that people would watch kind of kangaroos standing on their heads, that's what they'd show.
Tell me if this effect ever happens to you, since you watch TV a lot more professionally than I do. I mean, you have to really be gathering your thoughts, I imagine, as you watch it. Sometimes when I'm really depressed and I turn on the TV, this is when I turn it on in the hopes of it really doing something to undo this depression. It sometimes actually works. And I'll see someone who is, like, so screwed up in this TV program that I can really turn it off and feel, boy, you know, I thought I had it bad. These people on TV are really screwy.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of, a whole lot of kind of the sort of the serious entertainment programming has to do with people with major problems.
Right.
And a whole lot of the documentaries, I mean, it's sad, really, the documentarists seem to feel that documentaries, certainly in film and television, should by and large be punishing. Because there's an awful lot of punishment dished out in documentaries. And I think one of the reasons why people don't want to watch nonfiction television, and one of the reasons why these dreadful docudramas are much with us, is that documentaries have been defined since... I mean, not by Bob Flaherty. Flaherty was the last of the great non-punishing documentarists. But more or less since that time, CBS reports. I mean, they've all done fine work, and that's terrific. But I don't think that the message of toxic whatever is the only thing we're saying about this country. I mean, I'm not talking about kind of Reagan happy days. The reality of this country is ample and various, and I don't think that it needs only to be described in a punishing way. I mean, there's room for plenty of toxic stuff and, a whole lot of something else.
I'm talking to Michael Arlen, if you're just joining us, and the occasion of his visit is the publication of his new book of essays, The Camera Age. And this is an assortment of essays initially published in The New Yorker with some updates in them. And his book, 30 Seconds, about the making of a Bell telephone commercial has just been published in paperback. Do you watch commercials seriously when you're watching TV and look at how they're put together and what message they're trying to give you and how?
Well, having spent a long time working on one commercial for that book, 30 Seconds, I suppose I now watch them with a, you know, with a little higher consciousness or whatever it might be called. I don't suppose I watch them any differently than anybody else does, for the most part. Set about to do that book really because, the obvious reason that I was writing about television, and commercials certainly do seem to sit at the center of the television experience. And I'd listen to all these people say, well, you know, on the one hand, television, you know, commercials are dreadful and irritating, or they're the best thing on TV. And all of that made some sense, but never quite enough sense. And I thought what the world really didn't need any more of at that moment was another kind of a sort of a psychological interpretation of, commercials and so forth. So I thought I'd just hang out and see how they put one together.
Can you tell us, like, the hook, the premise and the hook for the commercial that you witnessed and wrote about the making of?
Well, it was one of those Bell Telephone Reach Out vignette commercials. In passing, I should say that one of the great artistic triumphs connected with that commercial was when the people at NW Air, the agency that produced it, figured out how to put in the second reach out, you see, because they spent just about a year figuring out the theme line. I mean, they had 24 theme lines, and then they narrowed it to 12, then to 4, and then they got it down to 2. And I think the rival theme line was, I believe, Keep in Touch America. And they had a big corporate meeting about Keep in Touch America, and they decided that the world didn't need any more America stuff at that moment. So they had Reach Out, but there was something lacking, you see, because they had a Reach Out and Touch Someone. And then someone thought, how about Reach Out and Touch Someone? And then light bulbs went on over everybody's head, and they said, that's it, you know. Anyway, that's a little bit of background to be helpful to you and your audience. But I think that the hook, really, is well, it's a much more general thing. First of all, you start with the music. And now you have this quality, I guess you would call it a quality, they call emotionality. And this is very tricky stuff. But if you think that nowadays, if you're on, you know, if you're watching a commercial and somebody's advertising, let's say, a bottle of soft drink, a cola. In the past, if you're advertising a cola, you got up there with this kind of Coca-Cola, whatever it is, and you said this is fizzy or it's not fizzy or it tastes, you know, sweet or it's 12 full ounces, that's a lot, whatever, you say something about it. But nowadays, you don't do that. If you're advertising Coca-Cola, you don't say anything about it. What you do is you show a bunch of cute, sing-songy, smiley young people doing cute, sing-songy, smiley things, with the result or with the idea in mind that your audience will associate the drinking of Coca-Cola or whatever with cute, sing-songy, smiley feelings, which apparently large numbers of people would like to have. The same with long-distance phone calling. People, I mean, by and large, those ads don't talk to you about the rates. Some of them do. One or two of them do. But most of them talk about the happy feeling, you know, the smiley feeling. So you associate having a wonderful time with making a phone call. And I think that's probably all right. It's harmless enough when you're selling long-distance phone calls or soft drinks. I'm not sure how it works when you're selling presidential candidates.
Do you see that same emotionality pitch in presidential campaigns now?
Our two most recent presidents have been elected, on the basis of being, by and large, smiley, and if not sing-songy, but anyway, certainly cute and smiley and rather simple men of the people and so forth. And to everybody's enormous surprise and petulance. All those people who had elected President Jimmy for the reason that he was cute and kind of smiley and kind of homespun, without really bothering to ask too much of anything else, then found themselves enormously disappointed, and as I say, quite petulant, that he turned out to have or not have all sorts of other, perhaps more relevant characteristics. They then went out and elected President Ronnie on the basis of President Ronnie being, by and large, cute and smiley. And I mean, clearly he is a nice guy. You know, there seems to be little doubt about that. But you wonder what people's disappointments are likely to be like if it turns out that perhaps other characteristics were needed and won't be there. I mean, anyway, I think it's part of the new world we're in, and people are trying to figure out ways of handling it.
Who am I when people are sitting down at an advertising conference and trying to figure out how to reach me? Because I figure I'm a part of the target audience as much as anybody else is, particularly for something like a campaign for long-distance telephone calls. I make quite a few and could easily make more. If, you know, I have friends in a bunch of places. I pick up the phone and call them when I can, but there's always this feeling of, oh, it's expensive. I should really hang up. I shouldn't make that phone call. So I consider myself to be, you know, definitely a part of, say, Bell Telephone's target audience. So who am I when they're figuring out how to reach me?
I wish you'd have a talk with some of my children who seem confused about the expensiveness. I tried to remind them on that.
Uh-huh.
I think all this market research gets very overstated, and as certainly does the so-called subliminal stuff. I mean, I think there's very little hocus-pocus in advertising. I mean, they did spend, for example, Bell system, long lines, spent, you know, great deal of time and a great deal of money trying to figure out who they were aiming these commercials at, but they knew that to begin with. You know, I mean, they knew a very general body, by and large, men and women between 25 and 45, though more women than men, et cetera. But, I mean, and by the time they'd done all the figuring and the computer printouts and so forth, that's, I mean, a massive generality, I mean, that they still had. I don't think that market research plays, well, perhaps more in product advertising, you know. But by and large, I don't think it plays a very important part, and I think it's very overstated, but about 10 years ago, all the big companies and agencies felt they had to get big marketing divisions and do a lot of polling and sampling and printout work, and so they do it. But I don't think it really tells them too much, and they told me quite willingly that, you know, they'll find research to support whatever it is that they're doing. I don't mean anything particularly demonological. I mean, one of the interesting things for me in doing that book was to find out that advertising now, I mean, television commercials, all other commercials, I suppose, are not produced by one of these sort of 1950s sort of failed priests, I mean, hucksters and so forth. I mean, they're very decent, hard-working bunch of people, and it may be that what they do strikes some of us as being a little lunatic, though I suspect it isn't really more lunatic than an awful lot else that goes on in this country.
What were some of your favorite lingo that you picked up hanging around advertising agencies?
Well, lingo, the fact is, I have a lot of that in my book, and naturally I can't remember it too much at the moment, though I try to keep that down a bit. Because in a way I don't think that's exactly fair, since I think everybody has lingo, since nobody has a region anymore. Everybody has lingo. I mean, you know, broadcasters have lingo, and policemen have lingo, and I mean, you know, teachers, everybody has sort of a jargon, and a jargon can sound pretty silly. I think advertising jargon has a little higher velocity of looniness because it's so quasi-smart. I mean, cowboys have a lingo, but it doesn't claim to be sort of terribly sort of, you know, intelligent and cultivated. But advertising lingo tends to be sort of a little insane, but it's no different than most other stuff.
I'm kind of surprised that everyone felt comfortable with you around.
Well, there was an interesting thing about that. When I was starting out, they were worried about one thing only. This was the one obstacle, really, that they put in my way. And was I going to write about their private life? And they were sweet to worry about that. I mean, although everybody's private life is important to them, the truth is some are more interesting than others. And I was able to reassure them with unequivocal honesty that I was not interested at all in their private lives. I mean, who might or might not be sleeping with whom or what, you know, I mean, the state of somebody's marriage, it had nothing to do with what I was writing about. So I was able quite happily to, give my word to them that I really wasn't interested in their private life, you know, I mean, maybe a little biographical background. What I wanted to do was hang out and see the process. Oh, that they thought, you know, why would anyone want to do that? Well, if you really want to do that, you'll be so bored, they said. Don't worry, I said. Don't worry. Then they were very nice to me. And I've also been, in a way, surprised at the number of advertising people who seem to be very pleased by that book. I mean, I think it has probably to do with the sort of the feelings of a defensive minority. I ran into that to some degree when I wrote a book about, let's say, being Armenian, a book called Passage to Ararat. I thought that... many of the Armenians, I am half Armenian myself, would take maybe a distanced view of some of the things that I said, which were somewhat critical or, you know, but they didn't at all. I mean, they said, oh, you know, we're so pleased that you wrote about us, now I can tell my neighbor what it is I am. Well, advertising people told me almost exactly the same thing, now I can tell my neighbor what I do. It was an enormously interesting way to spend 6 months. I read recently of one of the wonderful words that I pass on to you if you haven't heard it, optimization, which was defined by the only literate economist I know of, who is not Kenneth Galbraith but Kenneth Boulding, who defines optimization as the art or science of doing as well as humanly possible what either should not or need not be done at all. And when you stop to think about it, advertising certainly comes in under that category, but so does much in public life and much in private life. I mean, the Department of Commerce or packing the back of a station wagon. I mean, it's very noble and endearing, the energy that humans spend in doing as well as they possibly can, something that really often makes no sense at all.
I thought optimization was going to be the science of trying to make somebody optimistic, which is in a way what a lot of TV commercials try to do.
Yes,
through all that emotional stuff.
Well, some of them try to make you optimistic. Others try to irritate you.
Yeah.
You know, the ring around the collar. And people say, oh, I'm so irritated. How could they possibly sell anything through that? I guess they can.
We're running out of time, and I'm really curious what you'd consider to be the best programs on TV now, maybe one on commercial and one on public that you think are doing a really good job of doing what they do?
Well, I mean, I
know you don't see yourself as a consumer's guide to TV, but I figure you probably have...
In terms of my own taste, I like Lou Grant. I think I can actually watch Lou Grant kind of with a free mind, often a good deal of pleasure. Sometimes they get a little too, you know, positivist on there. They're always trying to bring in some new and topical journalistic, notion. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think that's a good kind of program. I mean, I think people get so, in a way, spoiled in their demands for entertainment. It's sort of fascinating. They just expect now all this entertainment all the time, and they get a lot of it, and an awful lot of it isn't very good, though I don't think it's supposed to be. I think the nature of television really is to be a very low-profile medium. The nature of television is to be something in a way that people can plug into so that they don't have to relate intensely to one another, because the psychiatric century has told us that we're supposed to relate intensely to one another, and this is an almost impossible burden for most people.
Do you have any shows on public television that you think are doing a good job?
Well, I think, you know, I think some of those, you know, non-fiction television, I mean, do a very good job in presenting, from time to time, I wish it were more often, the works of non-fiction filmmakers. I think that's good. I mean, there are a number of programs there.
Well, I wish we could talk some more, but we really
Likewise.
Are out of time. I've really enjoyed it very much. I've been speaking with Michael Arlen, who is the television critic for The New Yorker magazine, and he's written a number of books. Now, the most recent ones are The Camera Age, which is a collection of recent essays originally printed in The New Yorker. Many of them are revised or updated. And also 30 Seconds, which has just been published in paperback. And that's his, I'd like to call it a documentary. I know that's a film word,
no,
but
fine.
It really seems like a documentary book about
is.
The making of a 30-second TV commercial for Bell Telephone, the first Reach Out and Touch Someone commercial. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
It's 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.